Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Paradise author Leonce Gaitor began writing in grade school and continued through his graduation from Harvard. After college, he moved to Los Angeles and worked in the film and music industries and currently works in tech. Leonce Gaitor's nonfiction essays have appeared in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and the Washington Post. His fiction includes an historical novel, a period road thriller, and his latest book, which tells the story of a gay black man and the striving African-American middle class that shaped him in the 1960s. The title is A Memory of Fictions, or Just Titty Boom. Leonce Gaitor, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Now, that title in itself is a mystery. Okay, A Memory of Fictions, that's kind of understandable. Just Titty Boom?
Yeah, I'm a jazz fanatic, and the structure of the book is not linear. It's as if someone is remembering their life, and that structure was very jazz-like to me. I literally listen to jazz all day long when I'm working and have for decades. And that kind of, that shifting kind of kaleidoscopic emotional landscape is where I feel most comfortable. And there's a jazz drummer who once said to his band, "No bombs, just titty boom," right? And to my mind, that was the perfect metaphor for life, you know? Just titty boom in terms of that rhythm, in terms of keeping that drive going, in terms of keeping it even, right?
Well, when you say rhythm, I think of percussion, and
yeah.
I think of drums. Uh-huh. And so this sound that we're imitating, titty boom, mm-hmm. sounds to me like a drumstick hitting a drum.
Yeah, and that to me means like a rim shot. It means keeping the rhythm. It means keeping it going, right? The foundation of everything.
So that clears up, more or less, the title of the book, A Memory of Fictions, right. Or just titty boom.
Right.
Now, the cover has photographs of people who, I'm thinking, these look like real people.
They are. That is my father. That is me as a child. And a picture of my mother taken in front of a giant old car.
Well, you know, that's what I supposed when I looked at it. For one reason, mm-hmm. This is beautiful young woman against the car, which I thought, now that must be his real mother. And then I thought, well, that's got to be you, the young man there. But there's something that is maybe unexpected. We get an impression of what you thought of your dad, I think, by the cover.
Yeah, there are red.
Because your dad, here's this nice looking guy, and uh-huh. How's he dressed?
He's in his military uniform. Actually, that photograph was taken at his promotion ceremony.
And what was his rank when he retired?
He retired as a colonel. Yeah. And it was a full career, 30 years, the whole thing, right? So his entire life was spent in the military. And my father...
Well, now, how do we get the impression that maybe you didn't like this guy?
We didn't like each other.
But we get that impression because, did you do that?
Yeah, it's as if someone has scratched out that photo of the child and the father, like, X'd over it.
They're red lines going back and forth to cover this nice military man. And so we could, gosh, he must not have liked his
but
dad.
But it's also covering the child. It's like that relationship is being excised. Mm-hmm. That's what I wanted to suggest. And the book is about, it's odd because this book is about a person who, it harkens back to what the Germans called the Bildungsroman. It's about the intellectual coming of age of a particular individual. And this fella happened to have been born in, like me, in 1958, raised by Southern strivers. These were high-achieving, black middle-class folks. But this was back in the late 50s, early 60s. So there wasn't a lot of room for them. Everything was a battle. Everything was a fight. My father was the first in everything. He was in the military, which was desegregated before the rest of the country. So he was fighting every day. My mother was a teacher. She was fighting every day. They demanded that their children suggest perfection in order to win that fight that they knew they were going to have to wage every day. So there were these extraordinary pressures, which are not dissimilar to the pressures that a lot of immigrant families face in terms of the except this family, these Strivers, are desperate to reject a stereotype that the rest of society is desperate to put on them, right? And they put all of that burden on their children as well. So it's this constant tension between this young man who was born not to follow rules, born not to to stick with the status quo, and an atmosphere, a familial atmosphere that greatly values not making waves and sticking to the status quo. So there's this tension in the family, and you see it through this character's point of view.
My guest is Leonce Gaytor. He is a local writer now. He lives in Paradise now, but he was born in New Orleans. And your name is unusual, so people might say, what'd you say his name is? Leonce.
Correct.
L-E-O-N-C-E, and Gaytor, G-A-I-T-E-R.
That's it. The name is French. French origin. My mother was from New Orleans, my father from just a place outside New Orleans. So that French influence is very strong. So that's where the name Leonce comes in.
And your main character's family name is?
Grandier. Yes, suggesting that grandiosity that that the family sometimes indulged in.
Well, when you're telling this story, you are telling about yourself, just now, that is. Mm-hmm. You've been telling us about yourself, when you were born, where you were born. But that's also true of your character in your book. So when it says a memory, so this that you've been telling, that's true. That's autobiographical. But then it says affections.
And that's because I am not arrogant enough to believe that I am accurate. Our memories are incredibly volatile, imperfect things. I will talk to my sisters and I will say, remember when that happened? They'll say, that didn't happen that way. It happened this way. We have completely different recollections of the identical event, right? So this, no matter, I always also, when people write autobiographies, I always take it with a huge grain of salt because I know I lie to myself about myself all the time. I don't pretend otherwise. And so to suggest that I can provide an accurate accounting of my life was outrageous to me. So, okay, let's fictionalize this. Let's take things that actually happened. And my sensibility is a grand guignol sensibility. I think it's the Southern Gothic in me. But I am not a kitchen sink writer. I don't write about the, you know, the day-to-day, the average. The things I write about are generally larger than life. And even when I'm writing about the real world, I will paint it in larger than life dimensions. So I knew that my sensibility was going to infect the story with that grandiosity. And so I wanted to play into that. I wasn't going to try to pretend that I'm going to write accurately about myself or about anything in my life or about things that have or have not happened. I wanted to tell a story that sometimes intersected with my life, sometimes does not.
Well, why don't we meet your main character? And I'd like you to read just a little bit. Why don't you tell us, maybe you start reading, he's getting dressed for some reason. And so how does he get dressed?
Well, this is when he is down on his luck. He's in L.A. He's living in a barrio apartment, and he's getting himself ready for work. And remember, this is a character who has been raised to always reach the heights. He went to Harvard. He's supposed to be on top of the world, and here he is at the bottom. In the tiny hallway between the bathroom and the front door, he opened a small closet for the artful task of dressing. He chose the underpants with the fewest holes, ditto the socks. On the ground sat three old, well-worn pairs of shoes. Today he chose the black topsiders, the soles of which were split, but such that no one could tell unless he crossed his legs in the masculine fashion. Not likely. The clothes were mildly tattered, but clean, well-matched, and tasteful. Since they hailed from his better days, their wornness could pass for chic dishevelment.
You know what? I would like to call attention to one little phrase there that the listener might have missed. And he crossed his legs in the masculine. He said nobody could tell unless he crossed his legs in the masculine fashion. Not likely. So what does that tell
us
about this?
A little gay humor there. A little self-effacing gay humor there.
Okay.
Once dressed, he loaded his slim wallet in his back pocket, took enough change to board the bus with transfer, and headed for work. Such were the depths to which Jesse Vincent Grandier III had sunk. He had not been a fall-down gutter drunk or one that wept on bar stools at the mention of mother or friendship. In public, he drank moderately and behaved well. It was in private, behind locked doors, that he punished himself like a vicious child who had trapped some writhing creature. He had never foreseen such a fall, had not been raised to think events so chip-flint sharp could cut him, so bright and loud could blind and deafen him. His senses had been tuned to the American lie of ease and subtler things, dulcet tones, muted hues. After graduating from Harvard, he had barely set foot in his father's house in the D.C. suburbs before he fled to Los Angeles, where he soon took his first TV job in the mailroom. He had never been west of the Mississippi and rarely far from the academic underbellies of New York and Boston. He had come to make his mark in film, to write through great art, a deliverance from the strange, vaudevillian, death-besotted saga of his life. He had studied film under pot-bellied semioticians and Weasley philosophy PhDs, men who spoke of films in terms of sacred texts, a language in which Jesse had grown proudly fluent and knew to be the standard lexicon of all film folk. As with so much in his young life, the joke would be on him.
This is local writer Leonce Gaiter, and is reading from a book that's part fiction and part fact. A Memory of Fictions is the title. And you tell us that this character graduated from Harvard, and I think that's fact.
That's fact.
You don't have to rely on your memory for that.
Really, that one actually happened.
So you graduated from Harvard. His dad lived, and your dad, I'm assuming, lived in the D.C. suburbs before you and your character, you fled to Los Angeles, where he took his first TV job in the mailroom.
And I worked in the CBS television mailroom.
Because you don't say CBS, so I did wonder.
No, I did actually work in the TV mailroom. It's odd because the mailroom was considered, everybody in the mailroom had a college degree or a graduate degree. It was the place you went to start at the network, period, right? Unless your father was the president of the Red Network. If you were an ordinary person, you started in the mailroom. And then you'd spend several months there, and then you'd shift to whatever area most interested you or whoever grabbed you up, right? So the mailroom was considered the stepping stone to, you know, whatever career you would have there.
Well, you mentioned later in the book that your character has some written material under his arm, and I mentioned you like to write since you were a little kid.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, I'll bet Leonce took some of his writing with him to L.A.
Well, no, actually. I started serious writing when I was in, sort of in college, but after that. And my first idea was to work in film. And film, between the time I graduated from college or when I was studying, and by the time I was in the workplace, the film industry changed radically.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I was raised on classic Hollywood films and the 70s films of people like Coppola and Roman Polanski and, Truffaut and Hitchcock and everybody else. And then you have the Jaws blockbuster era. So, you know, I'm thinking this arty auteur type of filmmaking, and that's not what the industry's doing anymore. So, you know, it just wasn't for me. at that point. So I realized that also that I had turned to film because I was never satisfied with my prose writing, right? I simply didn't think it was good enough. And so I decided to buckle down and go back to prose and see if I could hone those skills.
So here's where we meet our main character, which it sounds just like you. And then you mentioned earlier you have sisters.
Yes.
In real life. And the character has sisters. And you point out that on the cover is a picture of this beautiful woman who I thought was your mother and is your mother. And you have a little bit about what the expectations were for her as the wife of, mm-hmm. here's this guy who, and probably most guys, they want a son for Pete's sake. So I'm going to ask you to read a little bit about, and I assume your mother as well as Jesse. Jesse is the guy in the book. Mm-hmm. And would you read about that? She's already had a couple of daughters.
Right. Okay. She had already born Janice and Talia, but his father needed a boy. His father, the youngest of 13 children, among the many males, not one having borne a son. The odds against this seemed extraordinary, clearly the work of impish, giggling gods. Jesse's father would thwart them, though, and produce an heir to the legacy of the Grandiers, a couple of acres of bayou swampland and an uninhabitable hut, all prized by this family as if the last remnants of an empire. Luline embarked on a third pregnancy despite doctors' warnings. They wanted to give her a hysterectomy after the second, but she refused. She had too much to gain by trying once more, by possessing what her husband so needed. She risked a lot, her life, at the hands of military doctors. Grandier, she always called him that, just Grandier, being in the army. Butchers with stethoscopes the lot. The black ones had an excuse, she thought. They joined up for medical degrees, the only way they could get them. But the white ones.
This is Leonce Gaiter reading from his book, A Memory of Fictions, or just Teeny Boom. I'll be back with my guest, Leonce Gaiter, after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Weekman. This is Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Paradise author Leonce Gaiter, who has written a book that is part memoir, part fiction. Now, this, I'm assuming, is pretty much correct, that your dad, the youngest of 13 children?
Yes, I think it was 13.
Okay.
I can't
okay.
be sure.
Well,
but it was in the teens.
Okay.
I think that's sufficient. It was in the teens. And he did have many brothers, and I am the last male of that line.
So your mother and your dad were both hoping, gosh, this time we certainly hope it's a son.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there you were.
And there I was. Unfortunately, sometimes the children are not the image that the parents have of what they should be. So, I could not have been something farther from my father's military and very structured and very rule-bound order. And that is reflected in the characters in the book as well. I think the main thing about this book to me is that it doesn't feel close to me, oddly enough. A lot of this did happen to me, mm-hmm. but it doesn't mm-hmm. feel close to mm-hmm. me because mm-hmm. the tools you use to fictionalize something are the same tools you use to create any fiction, right? Whether it's grounded in reality or not. So you know, the idea here was to create this world through this specific character's eyes that was palpable, that you felt like you could almost reach into, right? And to do that, you had to become, you had to live inside this character's head, right?
Yeah, and we learn about your mother, Luline, an unusual name, L-U-L-E-N-E, and that was your mother's real name.
That was her name.
But, and we see this beautiful woman on the cover, a photograph, but she didn't live very long.
No, she died young. She died when she was 38, rather suddenly. And, you know, I was just turned 13, I think. So, you know,
so
that's
there you
difficult.
A 13-year-old, say, and your mother is out of the picture, and here's this dad that wants a son, and you're nothing like, it sounds like, you're nothing like what he expected to have. And that's the case with this character. Jesse is the name of the character in the book. And there he is with a guy, and so his dad's living in Washington, D.C., and you and Jesse say, okay, I'm out of here. I'm off to Los Angeles.
Yeah. Having studied film in college, I wanted to go to Los Angeles. And oh, Los Angeles back then still had that aura, that gold, that glow about it. You know, it was the promised land. And it was back in 1980 when I graduated, it was livable and extraordinary, right? It was that last place you go for reinvention. I don't know if it still is to people, but it certainly was to my generation. And a bunch of us from school went out there.
Oh, so you went with some other people?
Yeah, yeah. A bunch of us wound up in LA.
And how old are you?
I'm 66.
No, no, well, I mean, at the time, you head off to Los Angeles.
At the time, I was right after college, 21.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. Wow. I was a baby.
A brave one at that. Now, there's a point in the book, too, and I thought, oh, gosh, is this true? Where your character, Jesse, considers the priesthood when he was only 10 years old. And your character is thinking, maybe I should be a priest.
I don't think there are too many kids growing up in strict Catholic high schools in Catholic schools, you know, going to Catholic schools, who didn't at some point say, yeah, I'll be a priest. You know,
it just... And you're only 10 years old.
You're 10 years old.
Yeah.
I mean, priest, veterinarian, firefighter, you know, you just switch them out. But it was a male authority figure you saw who wielded great power. So I think that's what attracted me to it.
So, by the way, you just mentioned kind of in passing that you were raised Catholic. Your mother was Catholic.
Yes, she was Catholic and she raised us Catholic.
And she was... I think you used honey color, like her skin was honey colored.
Yeah, she was what they in New Orleans call a Creole black woman in that she was very light skinned. She was light skinned and you know, there was a strict color hierarchy in slave societies where the lighter you were meant the more white blood you had, which meant the higher social order. There's still a lot of colorism in the black community whereby...
And you know, it's not just in this country.
Oh, no.
Other countries, too.
Any colonial power, any colonial country has inherited that.
The lighter colored your skin, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, that was very much part of that world growing up.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Leonce Gaiter, and he has written a novel that is part personal memoir and part fiction. The title is A Memory of Fictions. Or just Titty Boom. And that latter is kind of a hint at his affection for jazz.
Obsession.
Obsession. That's the word I was really trying to think of. So you like to write since you were, because your character, Jesse, liked to write since he was a kid. Yeah. But you get to Hollywood and you realize, this stuff I'm writing is not going to get me anywhere.
The stuff that they're doing is not what I want. It's not. You know, it's not speaking to me, and the things I want to do are not going to be welcome here. And, you know, oddly enough, it was the same thing in publishing, in that I write stories that mainstream publishing, you know, there's a movie called American Fiction. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it's a movie about a black writer who is being asked to write in a certain way in order to attract white audiences. And it's quite true to form about the publishing industry. And I don't want to write like that. right? I write characters who assume power. They assume, very often they want to radically change the world around them by whatever means necessary, and they assume they have the power to do it, and they take the means foolishly, outrageously, criminally, or whatever to do it, right? So that is something that's rare. Most of the fiction you see that involves black characters has to do with them in more of a victim role, them being acted upon as opposed to acting out, right? My characters act out.
Well, did this have anything to do with the fact that you turned to writing for newspapers?
Well, I did do some writing for publications for a while there, and that was also something that was interesting, but again, it's very difficult to actually say what I want to say. Again, I have that grand guignol sensibility, that, you know, larger than life sensibility that I work through comes out in my prose. And the very staid type of prose that is generally accepted in major publications is not my type of prose. I think you can tell from the reading, my prose has a tendency to trip and dance and flop and fly and do all kinds of strange pirouettes. And that's the way I write. Very few of the books I've read have been even linear in meaning that they go back and forth through time as this book does. So, you know, I have a kaleidoscopic kind of mind. I think I just, you know, I just lack logic. So I have wound up working sort of outside the mainstream, but, you know, when the mainstream gets a look at what I do, they're very extraordinarily praiseworthy. You know, they heap praise on it, but it's still not something that's very welcome. I tend to write books, I think, that have a discomforting aspect to them. Mm-hmm. They're not telling you things you want to hear necessarily.
I found that true in your book. Mm-hmm. Things, ugh.
They're not telling you things you want to hear. They're not giving you an image of yourself that this is, you know, oh, you're a wonderful person for reading this. No. you know, it's, I try to deal with what I think life is, and life is beautiful, horrifying, it's surprising, it's sometimes ugly, it's sometimes simple, it's sometimes warm, it's sometimes cuddly, but all of those things mixed together in no rational order. And I want to write in a way that brings the mess and beauty together in one rational narrative.
My guest is Leonce Gaiter, and he has written a book that is part personal memoir and part fiction. Now, this young man and you, off to Hollywood, off to L.A., and you get your start. But then what happens? And I'm guessing this is part of the memoir part. I want to ask you to read some of what happens later in the book that is just, oh, golly. It starts with the network layoff, and I'm guessing that's what happened to you. You got laid off from your TV job.
I did get laid off to my TV job, and, you know, that required a complete rethinking of the self, right? Mm-hmm. Self-worth and all of that. The TV network layoff had come a few months ago with a check for $5,000, and he decided, while looking for another job, to write. He worked long and hard, but the nights got longer and harder, too. Jobless, money running out, nights became fearsome things, each hour of the day like seconds on a detonator, the minutes before the explosion, when he had to face the night and the fears that lunge at him like ghouls. So during the day, he sat at his Macintosh writing about murders, betrayals, manipulative fathers and murderous self-loathing sons, feeling the scowl burn into his features as he wrote, the hate pouring into his terminal but freeing him from nothing. At night, he tried all the time. He'd lay down to bed with no liquor in the house, begging and pleading to fall to sleep, but instead fighting all the usual vultures, pecking and clawing. So he gave in. He got up and went to the corner liquor store and got the bottle and poured a tumbler full, climbed back into bed and sipped straight until he slipped into the only peace he knew. He remembered the time, the moment, sitting at his computer, at his desk, with a grimace contorting his face as he wrote, just as he finished, typed in the part in which one man asks what kind of hell it was he had come to and another answers, "It's my home." He realized this was real. There was no future time that he could pick like a suit of clothes at which his life would begin. He could not flick the on switch upon attaining fame or money or love he dreamt would follow those. It was, and it continued, even now. Even sitting there at his desk, the moments passed inexorably, one hopeless second after another, never to be retrieved or redeemed, one hopeless hungover second after another, and he didn't think he could bear it. The thought of that time, whole years, years and jobs he loathed with no one near him, years of waiting and hoping and getting nothing for it, of anger, of hating what they'd done to him and missing someone. Years and hates came tumbling back on him like explosions in films going backwards, debris falling back on him, a whole life's worth of debris, and that 28 years could spread such mess repulsed him. He realized that this was his life, this mess, not the rosy future he had planned, nor the tomorrows he had promised himself, but what had been and what was, this hell in which he spent each night running from dogs that would tear him apart if it weren't for that clear juice that silenced them.
This is local writer Leonce Gaiter, and he's reading from a book that is part fiction and part memoir, and the title of the book is A Memory of Fictions. Now, I don't have the experience of any family member or any relative with this situation, but this seems so real to me. I didn't have any trouble believing it, and because it seems so real, I thought, Leonce, that must be what you went through.
Not really.
Oh, well, you can have fooled me.
That was one of my first influences in writing was Faulkner.
Ah.
Right. Very disfavored and someone who, you know, people like to poo on these days. But Faulkner taught me what writing could be and the explosions that writing could unleash. And, you know, I wanted this character to have, when I talked about I got laid off and I
yes.
was down, I
yes.
wanted to take that and I wanted to amplify that to, you know, a truly life-altering event for this character. So I took what happened to me and I, you know, magnified it exponentially.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the feelings, of course, are there.
Yeah,
you
that's
know,
what
those were the
so
feelings that are. Yeah,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And he says that 28 years. He said a whole life's worth of debris, and that 28 years could spread such a mess repulsed him. So I'm wondering, did you have a downtime for that long?
Oh my God, yes. There was a time when, you know, again, you know, having been raised where you have to achieve, right? You have to get A's. If you did, you know, why didn't you get an A+? Did anybody get an A+? You didn't get an A+. What's the matter with you? That was my upbringing. You know, you get into Harvard. You're supposed to graduate from Harvard, and then life is supposed to be a clear sail upwards into the sky and off to, you know, to yeah. whatever glories. And it didn't work that way. You know, life doesn't work that way. Maybe for some people who are extraordinarily fortunate or misfortunate, it does, but certainly not for me. And so, you know, when all of those expectations are denied you, when everything you think is supposed to happen to you doesn't, right, you have to rethink everything. And for that to happen, I think you have to crash,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then find a way to find your feet again.
In fact, I read a quote by Lorne Michaels, Saturday Night Live mm-hmm. guy, and he said something about failure being, he said it was a positive. He felt it was a positive because then mm-hmm. it really got your, I don't remember the rest of it, whether it's your creative abilities come forth to solve the problem.
And that may be true, but it certainly doesn't feel like that in the moment.
Oh,
it just feels
I'm
like
sure of it.
Failure.
My guest is Leonce Gaiter. He lives in Paradise now, but he started out life in New Orleans and lived a while in Los Angeles, where he worked in the film and music industries. We'll be back after a break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North City Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman, and I'm back with my guest, local author Leonce Gaiter, who has written a book that is part memoir, part fiction. The title of the book is A Memory of Fictions, or Just Tiddy Boom. Well, we hear how this main character, Jesse, who has so many things in common with you, we hear what he's going through. But now, your dad, because I identify with an older person, he loses his wife at only 38. And I know they, from Jesse's point of view, they weren't getting along. I mean, it wasn't like a perfect marriage.
No.
But still, there he is, a widower.
Raising three children.
And I'd like for you to read. You have a chapter called Old Man.
Yeah, and this is toward the end of the father's life. Grandier sat before his television in a suburban townhouse near Washington, D.C. When his wife was still alive and the kids coming up, there had been a wood across the street, a full block of nothing but tall trees and undergrowth. It was gone now, and an apartment stood on the lot, buildings to which he had never grown accustomed. 10 years had gone by. When he walked outside and looked into the right, he still expected to see trees, and those brown buildings insulted him as if they slapped him with the inexorability of his life's waning and things leaving. They're passing him by if he dared step foot outside his door. He didn't leave the house much anymore. Nothing had changed in here. He'd bought no new furniture, changed no rooms, no curtains, no rugs, nothing. When Grandier walked in the living room, the couch still lay covered with the pillows she made. The painting she bought in Germany still hung over it. The Danish modern furniture still sat in the dining room, and behind the glass of the cabinet, the gold leaf plates and cut tinted crystal still sat for show. He had changed nothing. He hadn't changed the children's rooms. Talia still had the fake French provincial bought cheap, white with gold trim, frilly and girlish. Janice's room still bore her malice. She had kept it messy out of spite, knowing every time Grandier looked inside, he saw defiance, the heavy, dark wood furniture bespeaking her sheer weight of the contempt she loved to show for him. When he walked past that room, the memory of that contempt still hit him. Jesse's room. He still half expected to see that dog curled up on the bed, its head on the pillow like it thought it was a person, or sitting in that big windowsill looking out and barking at folks walking by. This one hurt the most. The room was on a corner and he couldn't see in, not just from walking by. He was glad of that. He hadn't looked in there in years. The maid wiped the dust away. His boy, the last one of the whole Grandier family, the last one in the whole world, his boy. He'd jump for joy when he heard it was a boy. He barely remembered his own father, but he knew what to do. He always read the stories in the paper about fathers and sons, anything to do with them, stories about them building things together and doing things together. You might say he studied it, fathers and sons, so he knew what to do. And almost from the start, it went wrong. The boy didn't like to touch him, cried when it was near him. He thought the boy would get used to him, so he would hold him while he cried. Just hold him, shushing and assuming he would get used to him and quit his crying, worst come to worst, just get tired and sleep. He never stopped, turning his little head away and face so small but all screwed up like it tasted something sour, a face Luline had when she hated him and he kissed her and tried to make up with her. It was like he inherited that face from her. She was so pretty. Everyone said so. She made all those army wives look like hags. They just didn't know. He said his children would never know what went on between them, what happened behind closed doors, but they acted like it didn't matter. They only saw the fights and the cussing. Those kids thought that was all that mattered, but that was all there was. He thought he was the luckiest man in the world when he walked into that room and saw her lying there so beautiful with that beautiful boy in her arms, his little eyes closed, his skin honey, and his hair black silk on his head. This is mine, he thought. At first, he kept himself busy. Having been in the Army Transportation Corps, he traveled cheap, so he flew back and forth between New Orleans and Platteville visiting. In the beginning, he would visit Talia or Janice or they would come home. He didn't mind if they just came to borrow money or get something they'd left in the house. Jesse never came. He didn't know how he got here. He didn't know how she died. He couldn't see how he got left sitting in this house, full of nothing but old things that reminded him of what he hadn't done and who hated him and who would rather have died than go on living here. He didn't know how it had happened. He would live long. Everyone in his family did. The graying, thinny hair, joints that wouldn't move, heart beating irregular. It wasn't that. It wasn't the body, the spirit, whatever you call it. Whatever made him want to go on wasn't there anymore. Whatever joys he took were gone.
This is local writer Leonce Gaitor. He has just read a section from his book, A Memory of Fictions. And this person he's describing, the feelings of this man he's describing, your dad, all the facts are true of your dad, but you had to...
How he felt, I don't know.
Yeah.
This is my take. This is what I, from the outside, saw. Whether or not that's accurate, of course, it's neither here nor there because, you know, this is, in the end, a work of fiction. But this was my way of trying also to understand.
That's what it seemed, yes.
To understand him, in order to write like this, you have to see from everybody's point of view.
Exactly.
Right? So, you know, his point of view, my point of view, his mother's point of view, my mother's point of view, it's all there. And those point of views often conflict, right? But it's fascinating to try to make a narrative out of these conflicting point of views. So, you know, that was my challenge here, and that was the fun of writing this.
I think so many fathers or mothers, for that matter, in his position where the children are grown and they've left home and he's walking through this house that just has memories, I think so. This seems so real. Mm-hmm. It almost made me cry, I got to tell you. Because I have a friend who, this sounds like, he could have been saying these words, this friend of mine, could have been his words. That you,
but I think also my being older now allowed me to write this, right? I could not have begun to understand as a younger man, right?
Yes.
So, you know, I think being able to bring a lifetime of experience here and look back through that lifetime of experience and fictionalize through that lifetime of experience, mm-hmm. I think that's what makes the book what it is.
And I think that's why it touches us, because we might have different backgrounds, but these feelings that you describe, like with your dad or mm-hmm. your main character, mm-hmm. oh my gosh, even if not for ourselves, friends, people mm-hmm. that we know.
Yeah.
And so that's why your book is fiction, but it's realistic in so many ways.
Yeah, and I get that about all my books, even books that are clearly just purely fiction. And I don't think we're single people. I think we're a whole lot of people, each one of us. So it's a matter of, it's almost like acting in print. You literally put yourself, you become another character and you write. I become another character and I write from that character's point of view, right? That's the way I write. So I think that sense of intimacy is a matter of writing from the inside out versus looking in, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm. Well, are you writing another book now?
I'm thinking on another book. There's a certain story that I have to figure out how to build on. I sincerely believe, and again, being a jazz fanatic, I sincerely believe in I write to entertain. You know, Duke Ellington being one of my heroes, some of the most, I think, perfect music of the 20th century, and I think some of the most concert-worthy music of the 20th century. But he always knew how to entertain an audience, right? So you are writing brilliant scores, but you are entertaining that audience. It's none of that, I suffered from my art, now it's your turn to suffer from my art stuff, right? So I write to entertain. So how do you take these stories, sometimes dark stories, and how do you make them irresistible, right? Yeah. I wrote a book called I Dreamt I Was in Heaven, and it's about a group of teenagers who tried to overthrow the U.S. government in 1895 to retake Indian lands from white encroachers, right? Now, what these people did was unconscionable. It was horrible, right? And it was a horrible time. But, you know, how do you make that entertaining? How do you keep someone reading that? How do you make that something that's not just unpleasant, right? So you have to figure out the world around these people. And again, the way I write is the characters sort of project the world as opposed to live in it.
And, you know, even if something is fiction, even if I know it's not true, it needs to have enough realism that I can follow it and stay engrossed in the story or with the character. Because if there are things that, no, that doesn't seem like the person would do that.
Yeah, and it's and to my mind, that's where the world comes in, these characters projecting the world around them. It's sort of, you know, again, I studied classic Hollywood films. In the best of them, everything on a set is telling you something about that character, right? It's telling you about something about that scene. It's giving you information. And I think everything in a book should be the same way. The world around them should never be external to them. It should be the result of them, right? So that you get this immersive experience as a reader.
You know what? I imagined you teaching a creative writing class. You know, we have Ollie here and Chico, and you just drive down from Paradise.
I have that much patience.
Oh, but for listeners, you're holding your fingers about a half inch apart.
Yeah.
You don't think you'd have the patience to teach creative writing?
You know, well, I've often said I'd never do things and I wind up doing them. But I've never seen myself as that. In that pedagogical role.
Well, we'll be curious to hear how things turn out for you, your next chapter in your life. Thank you, Leonce.
Thank you.
My guest has been Leonce Gaiter. He has written a book, A Memory of Fictions, or just Titty Boom. And next we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
A fly with one wing is watching me. I remember this fly from long ago, when it had two wings. I was living in Boston, tried to kill it so many hot summer nights, terrorized me as I tried to sleep, circling the chaos in my head, knew him so well I called him Jack, tried to make it a fun thing, this fly intent on ruining my life. Now he's in L.A., languishing on the soft chair across the room, watching me work. I can see he's less a fly since he's lost a wing, and I want to know his anguish. Come here, little fly, I gently call to him. But flies are so nervous, they think we're all trying to kill them, so they don't wait to hear what we have to say. I approach him slowly, put my finger out, invite him to hop on, but he doesn't move. Maybe his one wing is too tired to lift. So I sit next to him, remind him of his glory days back when he could torment me, how much fun it must have been for him. He doesn't move. I consider flicking him across the room or smashing him right there, but why? It's clear he came by to see me, find out how I'm doing. Acknowledge the past when his buzz was his life and he couldn't resist being the best fly he could be. Kim Dower.
where I am from, Sauerkraut City, whose roads have a jolt that wakes me to pigeons' coos, gives us yangling and pierogies for breakfast, makes us watch herons who stroll the river's edge now that the water is mostly clean. Dinosaur skeletons love the dark museum. T-Rex's jaws thrill kids even though he lacks skin. There are no words for Apatosaurus' long neck, that tunnel between her mouth and guts. There's no way to describe the storm's distant flash that ignited our hills but gave no thunder. Us kids called it heat lightning, though it was cold. There are no words for the fireflies who danced beneath the great bear and flashed hellos back at her. No words for crickets whose chants built hot nights. No word for cigar smoke that stung like sauerkraut. No words for my Pittsburgh. Paul Belts.
Four questions you can't ask your doctor pre-op. Where is the wise mother who knows my wounds and helps them heal? How have I come to this, robbed of expression and gesture, reduced to the body on the table in a cold room among strangers who approach me with deliberate objectivity and calculation? Where will I hide until it's over? And how do I know I will return to health, to privacy, to a sense of worth not measured in centimeters or pounds, but alive in the way I brush my hair, in the arms that embrace me, in the words I long to speak? Amy Gaffney.
Haiku. Ever thing is fro-zen, except the deep mud road. Blankets, bones, frost stiff. I'm Mike McMillan.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.